Lovely to see you all here. Really lovely to see you all here. Nice to have a full room. Lovely to see you. Particularly welcome to Mark Doty. I can't tell you how pleased I am to finally meet Mark. I've been reading his poems for many, many years, and he's coming to Poetry East at the London Buddhist Centre this Saturday. So I hope you'll all en masse go to London on Saturday to come and hear more about Mark and his life and his poetry. But today is our Wallace Stevens marathon, although I would have liked it longer. Originally, the idea was to have a whole day on The Man with the Blue Guitar. Actually, I'm slightly relieved we didn't do that, because there's a lot to go into. So that's why we've got The Man with the Blue Guitar here, Picasso's Old Man and Guitar. Just to say, the reason we're having this day on Stevens is because he's just a really wonderful poet. I was rereading Stevens for the umpteenth time, and I really felt I wanted to, get Stevens out there a bit more. I still feel he's undervalued in England, underread in England. I keep going back to him again and again, and I keep finding more and more. And I got very excited about the idea of doing a day here at the Ledbury Festival. And Chloe, who's here somewhere, I remember talking to Chloe on the phone and said, "What about a day on Wallace Stevens?" And Chloe's always up for a challenge, and she's always up for something more creative, more outside the box. So I was delighted that she went for that. So this morning we had an oral textual immersion in The Man with the Blue Guitar, including songs specially commissioned by Poetry East and the Ledbury Festival from Taylor Burton, and we're going to hear one of his songs in a moment. Also wonderful readings by Vishvantra and Padmavadra of The Man with the Blue Guitar, and the kind of exploration into The Man with the Blue Guitar. Every time I explore Stevens, I think, oh gosh, there's so much more to explore. I wanted to spend a long time this morning on the word green and what green meant for Stevens and so on. And then just earlier on this afternoon, we had a panel with emerging critics talking about different perspectives on Stevens, looking at three Stevens poems. But this afternoon, this is our sort of grand finale of the day, is to introduce Mark Doty to you, and I'll be in conversation with Mark. And what we'll be doing is, I'll be in conversation with Mark in the first half, and then we'll have a cup of tea. I'm the founder of Poetry East, and that's why we've got a shrine here, because we always have a shrine. It was always at the London, mostly at the London Buddhist Centre, so the shrine of the London Buddhist Centre is behind on a Poetry East evening. So we sort of take one everywhere we go. And the reason why we do that at the Buddhist Centre is because we want to really just promote excellence in writing, in the arts. We recently had Anthony Gormley. I recently interviewed Jory Graham. We've got Anish Kapoor coming early next year. So we want to, at the London Buddhist Centre, we really want to say that there's something essential about imagination that's essential for all of us. And Stevens is the great poet of imagination, the great poet of a question between reality, things as they are, as he says in The Blue Guitar 20 times, things as they are compared with The Blue Guitar, compared with the blue of imagination. In a way, Stevens' whole work is imagination's blue against reality's killer green. And we've explored that in various ways today, but I'm really pleased that we're going to be exploring that with Mark. So what I'd like to do, before I introduce Mark properly to us, I'd like us, very hot day, isn't it? But let's not complain, because this is like a summer in a lifetime. I remember 1976, anybody here remember 1976? Yay! Let's hear it for 1976! We're back there! So let's really enjoy it, hot though it is. So what we thought we'd do is we'll have a little moment just to meditate for a moment, just to settle ourselves down, cool down, so that we can give our full attention to Mark and to the poetry of Wallace Stevens. So if you're happy to, if you'd like to, just close your eyes. And with your eyes closed, you can immediately get a sense of how your day has left you. So you don't need to ask yourself how you are, because that usually just gets you thinking. You just need to know how your body feels. And how your body feels is how you are just now. and you can help yourself arrive here at the festival and for this evening by really noticing your body. So much of our time we spend, as Eliot famously said, distracted from distraction by distraction. So see if you can create an antidote to that by just noticing the weight of your body on the chair. You don't need to think about that. You don't need to picture it. You just need to feel it. And you can help your weight rest on the chair by just softening your belly. Without noticing it, we're often gripping onto our belly, and that affects our mind. So see if you can, just see if you can soften your belly. And then you can see if you can let go of your shoulders. So again, we're often gripping with our shoulders. We don't notice that. But it's always affecting our mind and our mood, giving this background kind of tension. So as best as you can, see if you can release your shoulders. Even if that's just imagining your shoulders releasing. So your weight is heavy on the chair. And your belly is soft, and your shoulders are soft. So you're calming down your whole system, calming the body, calming your mind.
Sing a song today. You're nothing to me. This buzzing of the blue guitar. This buzzing of the blue guitar. It's nothing to me. It's nothing to me. to me. Oh man, you're my number one, and nothing has changed. This buzzing of the blue guitar.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. Yeah, really beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm really delighted, having created that right mood. I'm really delighted to introduce Mark Doty to you. Mark's many honours include the National Book Award, the National Critics Circle Award, and the T.S. Eliot Prize. I first read Mark's poems when a friend bought me the School of the Arts, and I was immediately struck by Mark's incredible combination of grace and grit. He seems to me a poet who wants to say yes to the beauty of things and find the beauty of things. There's some poems where you can almost feel him straining in difficulty to find the beauty of things, and they're made stronger for that strain, as it were. And a poet who's wanting to be really honest about life, really honest about even the difficulties of life, the grit of life. And that sense I had reading the School of the Arts was deepened and enriched by his wonderful collection, My Alexandria, which I was drawn to because I'd read Colm Toibin's essay on Mark's poetry, and I immediately rushed out and bought My Alexandria, and then I read Atlantis, the next collection he published after that. And I've been really reading Mark's work ever since. I mean, I spent a weekend just recently in this lovely hot sunshine just having this glorious time reading Deep Lane, his most recent collection that published here in the UK. And again, new things coming into the poems that I hadn't seen before. Really, really wonderful. So I was very excited. We've been in contact. Would you be able to come over? He's flown all the way over from New York. We had to have a stiff coffee to welcome him here to the Ledbury Festival. So hope everyone give Mark Doty a really warm welcome.
The meditation and the lovely music has sent me sailing quite away. So this may be good for the audience, but I'm going to need some more coffee. Maybe I'll try that.
We might send out for some if we need some.
We'll see what happens.
So welcome, really good to see you. And as I say, we're going to be, I'm going to be focusing more on you and your poetry on Saturday night in London. So, you know, we'll get a bus, we'll all go down there in the hot weather. But I did want to, and that's when I'm going to mostly talk about you, Mark, and your own work, which I'm very keen to talk about. But tonight we're going to be exploring together the poetry of Wallace Stevens. But I wanted to start by just asking you, when poetry first entered your life, either reading it or writing it, Stevens in a letter says, "Poetry then is the only possible heaven." I quoted this morning. "Poetry then is the only possible heaven." So when did that heaven, if it was felt like you to a heaven of poetry, enter your life? And how would you describe the poetry, the impact it had upon you?
I was in high school, which means 14, 15, and the relationship I felt to Stevens actually surprises me. I've been thinking about this in preparation for this conversation because I don't, although I love much of Stevens, I never particularly thought about him as an influence. Mm. And your invitation to this conversation provoked me to think about that. I remember coming across a poem that we're going to talk about in a little bit here called Disillusionment of 10 O'Clock, which is a depiction of a world a little heavy on ordinariness. Things have grown a little gray, a little plain. There is not the kind of color and vivacity to experience that the poet would like. And what the imagination locates, imagination, image, the making of image, those images that are loaded with power and possibility and promise, that they offer a kind of richness to us that is not so easily found in the daily. So that is pretty much a description of how I felt at 14, that the suburbs of Tucson, Arizona, seemed to me to be rife with the ordinary, a landscape I knew, but wasn't there something else on offer elsewhere? Wasn't there a world of imagery which suggested behind it a life of the spirit, of greater possibilities for human experience? Now, I had encountered images like that before, first in hymns that my family used to sing. I was born in East Tennessee, a Protestant family. We would sit on the porch swing on summer nights and we would sing. And we sang songs like, I looked over Jordan and what did I see coming for to carry me home, a band of angels coming after me. Now, think about being 4 or 5 years old and imagining a band of angels coming across the river to take you home. That's a really quite powerful image. Oh, so many of those. He's a lily of the valley. He's a bright and shining star. So I cling to the old rugged cross till my trophies at last I lay down. So those images for me were the first poetry, but I didn't think of them as poetry. And their power was partly because they were sung. But somehow, I don't really understand quite how this happened, wandering around the library in high school, going to the local head shop, which was on 4th Avenue in Tucson, which is where you bought sandals and stash boxes and glasses with prisms in them. There were poetry books, face out. There were so few of them. There was a collected Lorca. There was Allen Ginsberg. There were, early books published in the States by Kayak Books, poets like Charles Simic and Herbert Morris that were interested in surrealism and therefore offered images of great power and high color. So those images were the first thing that drew me in.
And can you remember the first Stevens poem that...
Yeah, you want to hear it?
Yeah, yeah.
Here we go. I just happen to have that right here.
We did have a coffee beforehand.
Okay, the page number of that poem. Hold on. So this is from Harmonium, Stevens' first book, and it's called Disillusionment at 10 O'Clock, of 10 O'Clock. That's an interesting distinction, the disillusionment at 10 o'clock versus the disillusionment we feel of 10 o'clock, what 10 o'clock brings us. 10 o'clock is, in the morning, is the hour when the day has really gotten going, right? 10 o'clock is when, this is what it's going to be now. Disillusionment of 10 o'clock. The houses are haunted by white nightgowns. None are green, or purple with green rings, or yellow with blue rings. None of them are strange, with socks of lace and beaded censures. People are not going to dream of baboons and periwinkles. Only here and there, an old sailor, drunk and asleep in his boots, catches tigers in red weather. Want to hear that again? The houses are haunted by white nightgowns. None are green or purple with green rings, or green with yellow rings, or yellow with blue rings. None of them are strange, with socks of lace and beaded censures. People are not going to dream of baboons and periwinkles. So we've had here the whole negation of all that color, all that possibility, and then we come to only here and there an old sailor, drunk and asleep in his boots, catches tigers in red weather. Now, what does it mean to catch tigers in red weather? It means brilliant orange and power and heat, fire, in a field of red. It calls to mind a screen, maybe Japanese, maybe Tibetan. It is saturated with something outside of the ordinary, something outside of the world where people don't wear nightgowns with purple rings on them. And I could not have explained at the time why that spoke to me so potently, but it certainly did. And something about the isolation of that image that the poem gives us just that, only here and there. These drunk old sailors are dreaming of this. That's it. And that has to reverberate and do its work on the imagination of the reader without the help of abstraction, without much in the way of explication. There it is. Take the image and do with it what you will.
Very interesting. And then I was, you know, going on from that first poem, when did you start writing yourself? And can you remember Stevens as an influence then when you started writing?
I started writing right around the time I found those first poems that I loved. And they were short poems that I was drawn to, poems where there was a sense that beneath the surface of language, something was roiling, something was full of depth charge. And I could, well, Lorca's a great example. You can translate one of the Gypsy Ballads, say, into English from Spanish. You cannot translate it from poetry into prose. What verde, que te quiero verde, green, I love you green, what is that? It is a statement of feeling that can't be reduced to something more plain. And that was really attractive to me. I found it in Lorca, in Blake, in Paul Eluard, in even Eliot. Those images that could have a life independent of any other way of understanding them. They simply had to be taken in and lived with and felt. So that, in a way, is why that kind of poetry could work against the ordinary, because you know, when we explain something, when we communicate something to someone, we can talk around it, we can say it seven times, we can say it another way until we know our audience understands us, but the image is irreducible. It's just a fact of perception presented to us, and when it works, it has the force of thunder. The apparition of these faces in the crowd. You know, why does that little poem, 17 words, I think it is, have such a hold on us?
Indeed. I mean, reading in preparation for Saturday, rereading your Fire to Fire New and Selected Poems, which won the National Critics Circle Award, I was wondering, on first reading, it doesn't look like you're influenced by Stevens. I think on second reading, I think it does. But on the first reading, you're particularly concerned, much more concerned than Stevens, to be accessible, to talk about a life that we can recognise.
One of the strange things about reading Stevens is that you could read this entire thing and have very little sense of who made this. Did this person love anybody? Did he have a life outside the head? Well, of course he did, but you wouldn't know it from the poems. There's no attachment to autobiography that is evident here.
Right? I mean, even when he quotes speech, there's no sense of it being actual, possibly like
no.
a speech.
No, there's lots of very artificial speech, heightened speech. He likes the literary, he likes pastiche, he likes to strike poses of various kinds.
But you go get to know him, and one of the things that's different in your work is that you are very keen to get to know us in a way and have us get to know you. The things that I thought might be, I don't know, I'd be interested to see what you think, the things I thought might be influenced by Stevens from you is you've got a very strong philosophical questioning that runs all the way through Stevens. Yours is in a different tempo and in a different key, less abstracted, less difficult in a certain sense, less aslant, but also your fascination with description. Stevens' descriptions, even though they're very short, are wonderfully vivid.
Marvelous. Right.
You know, they're like wonderful little moments. Would you say those are two things that have influenced you with Stevens?
Well, certainly I would agree with you about the philosophical. It seems to me that poetry is a kind of, for me at least, is a kind of natural philosophy. One looks at the world, one looks at what strikes one, goes to say what it is, and the next question, after you've described that flower that you so loved, or the appearance of that cloud, or the light in so-and-so's eyes, is, so, what is it about that you want to say? You know, it isn't enough to describe the surface of things or to evoke some aspect of the world. It's that matters to you somehow, that it suggests meaning, that it's something that you want to show someone else about what you have seen. So the next question is to look into the description and say, upon what does this energy rest? Where does it come from? So if I'm describing, let's give you a good example. Well, upon about mackerel. I had been to the fish market. I had seen on ice the rows of mackerel and found myself riveted by the beauty of their scales, the colors, the incredible sheen of these things. And then as I was beginning, just with pleasure, to describe what those fish looked like, I realized that there was no difference between any single one of them that I could see. It might be that to another mackerel, in fact, there were beauty and less beauty and all kinds of distinction, but for me, they were exactly the same. And therein lay the possibility of a poem, that why was I moved by something where there was no individuality? Why did the collective seem so powerful? And as I began to continue that poem, I understood that I had been very concerned with the idea of the individual self disappearing. This was during the crisis years of the AIDS epidemic, and I thought, if a self is something that can go away so easily, what was it? Was it ever really here? And so the poem becomes a meditation on identity. Began with beauty, but it couldn't just stop there. So I think that's the Stevensian impulse, that you go through the image, through the thing, towards reaching for meaning.
And there's a sense with Stevens that in all the major poems that he's very much thinking and feeling his way, isn't he? He's not
very
knowing.
Right.
Sometimes people think that Stevens is a sort of cold philosophical poet who's already cooked it all up and then puts it into the sort of pots of poetry.
Right.
But he's really thinking his way, isn't he?
He doesn't have a clue until he gets there. And for him, thus, the making of poetry is this active engagement in being conscious and being alive. I very much admire that. And it results in a self-consciousness about what poetry is. And that's another thing I share with him. And I think I'm always asking questions in the poems about what can a poem do? What is this poem doing?
That's another thing, isn't it, that in your poems is this questioning about what poetry is.
Yeah, I'm really not so interested in poetry being transparent in the sense that we simply would look through the language toward experience and forget that we're reading a poem. I think it's a good thing for a poem to be conscious of itself as language, to consider what the limitations and possibilities of language are.
I mean, one of the things that strikes me with Stevens is this kind of incredible vividness of description. Very briefly, in fact, sometimes the abstractions of Stevens, sometimes it can seem so abstract, but then, so when he does talk about, I don't know, a set of descriptions, it's incredibly vivid. Mm-hmm. You've written a book called On Description.
The Art of Description.
Art of Description, that's right. That seems another thing that you're just as concerned with as Stevens, is how to describe, and as you say, how to then get to, why am I describing that?
This begins for me in the work of Elizabeth Bishop, too, and she and her friend and mentor, Marianne Moore, were mistresses of description, that they would play it as a game. Who could make the best description of the elephant they've just seen in the circus? Or, you know, when Bishop describes the Galapagos turtles as, you know, tea kettles that are lumbering along with the spouts coming up. You know, this precisions and a kind of pleasure being taken in how much distance there can be between the vehicle and the tenor. How far from the physical fact of the turtle can Bishop go and still have it feel like she's talking about the turtle, right? How much can she link the natural and the artificial, or the soft and the hard, or the liquid and the solid? So enjoying that tension becomes part of the game. And I just love to collect descriptions. This little book called The Art of Description is basically a gathering of many poets' descriptions of this and that. I could have continued that for years. Very fun project.
And let's have a look at another Stevens poem that you've been touched by
In light of this conversation about description, this is a good example of Stevens' profound affection for the tropical, the indulgent, the fecund. You know, this guy lives in Hartford, Connecticut, which is no one's idea really of a tropical paradise or or even a welcoming city. It's a cold, hard place, particularly in winter. He was obsessed with Florida, the tropics, with he fills the poems with Latin names, Latin and Spanish names. He equates the tropical with paradise, a love of all things blooming, green, and verdant. So this is an example of this. Now, this poem has a little interesting history. It's called Nomad Exquisite, or Nomad Exquisite, depending upon what language you think the title's in. And it was sent as a postcard, apparently, to Harriet Monroe, a poetry magazine. I found that impossible to believe until I remembered that very old-fashioned postcards, you know, don't have a picture on the back. You have the space, address on the front and on the back, you have that whole space to write. So I think in his tiny little meticulous printing, Stevens actually could have done this. No, my extras. Now, this is one sentence, so notice that this poem is incredibly taut. Nomadex was it. As the immense dew of Florida brings forth the big-finned palm and green vine angering for life, as the immense dew of Florida brings forth him and him for the beholder, beholding all these green sides and gold sides of green sides and blessed mornings, meet for the eye of the young alligator, and lightning colors so in me come flinging forms, flames, and the flakes of flames. So this is a description of the imaginative process, of what happens when we look at the world. And just two things to tell you, let's see. Brings forth him as in a song, him and him, and meet for the eye of the young alligator as in it is truly meet and right and our bounden duty, that kind of meet, okay? So here it is again. As the immense dew of Florida brings forth the big fin palm and green vine angering for life, as the immense dew of Florida brings forth him and him from the beholder, beholding all these green sides and gold sides of green sides, and blessed mornings meet for the eye of the young alligator and lightning colors, so in me comes flinging forms, flames, and the flakes of flames. So out of the natural world, the green, the beauty of that, comes flinging in me forms, flames, and the flakes of flames, which is a lot of Fs. And those are interestingly metallic, hard, unlike what you might expect nature to engender. Something is being hammered out, forged in those lines. Forms, flames, and the flakes of flames. It sounds like the blacksmith, right? Hammering out his metalwork in response to the beauty and fecundity of the world. Interesting tension there. It's a beautiful little poem.
Beautiful poem, isn't it?
And it's unusually clear, I think.
Yes.
You know, Stevens said he wanted to, thought a good poem should almost successfully resist the intellect.
Yeah. And then you've got this other side of Stevens. You know, that is Stevens at his most lush and sensual. But then you've also got this kind of, well, he has an almost sort of kind of hermit-like disgust for the world at times. Mm-hmm. I think a very noble one. But I wonder whether what you think of that. And
well, a severity, a sense that the coldness and unyieldingness of the world calls for a kind of, you know, a sort of stoic attitude, and one that, I guess, that pleasure in imagination and in a longed-for lushness is a kind of response to that. So he seems to be able to name the severity of his situation or escape from it in this way. I don't know if he escaped from it in other ways or not. He apparently carried on a bit on the insurance workers' conventions when they went to Florida hotels. He was known for dancing with a Coke bottle in his trousers on one evening, apparently.
Not something I read in the biography, but anyway.
Yeah, left that out, I suppose. You can see why.
Yeah. And then we'll come back to some more particular poems in a minute, but a lot of people particularly draw out this late phase of Stevens. So you've got these incredible early poems in Harmonium that still some people prefer. You've got Sunday Morning and so on. Then you've got these incredible experiments in extended form that Helen Vender talks so well about in On Extended Wings. Then you've got this remarkable late Stevens where there's a new sobriety, a new coming to terms. It's almost a different poet at times.
Right. I feel myself that I'm still coming to terms with those later poems. I don't know that I know how to read them. It seems to me that I want to say the great poems, but the poems that to me have the most rich and compelling life are sort of in that middle ground where he goes beyond the image making of Harmonium, the shorter vivid poems, to something that also really reaches for a meaning that goes beyond individual experience. In the greatest of his poems, which are to my mind Sunday Morning and The Idea of Order at Key West, he is reaching to make something for all of us to sort of both build an image and make a place for human imagining in the world, a place that can be valued in art, a place to stand in light of a rather dire worldview.
There's something sort of terribly sad about the late work, almost depressed at times. I was struck. I was watching something with Helen Bendler, and she was saying that she regretted writing about An Ordinary Evening in New Haven. She felt that she hadn't got it, and that it was only now she'd got older that she could see what Stevens was doing, and that she rather wished she'd not written about it then and waited to write about it, as if it was a poem that you could only understand with age, with its sort of terribly disenchanted feeling. So you're wanting something between disenchantment and enchantment?
I'm not quite ready to move to that position of terrible disenchantment.
I do.
I think that... why don't we read The Idea of Order at Key West? Want to do that?
Let's do that.
It seems to me... Except I was going to do it later, but that's all right. we'll do it now. I think this is a poem that, despite the way it says, essentially, the world is meaningless around us, that meaning can only be made by us, and that the gestures we make to make art chart the world for us. That's all there is. Now that's a fairly dire view. It means that we are alone with trying to order what is around us, that we have no spiritual guide, that we have nothing to look forward to. We have just this time here to make what we can to understand the world. Nonetheless, it is a poem of such beauty and such joy. So here it comes. Stevens loved Florida, and Key West was a place that he frequently visited. Any of you been to the Key West? There is a hotel on the southern side of the island, still standing. It's now a Ramada Inn or something. But in Stevens' day, it was quite a fine hotel, and it's where he liked to stay. And when I read this poem, I always think of him in that location, walking along that bit of beach. Ramon Fernandez, who is mentioned here, is a rather obscure philosopher of the 1920s who, as far as I can tell, his work bears no real relationship to the poem at all. I would suspect that Stevens just really liked his name because it's that sort of exotic thing he would enjoy. I think he included him so he could say, "Oh, blessed rage for order, pale Ramon." So here it comes. Anything else I need to tell you? I don't think so. The Idea of Order at Key West. She sang beyond the genius of the sea. The water never formed to mind or voice, like a body, holy body, fluttering its empty sleeves. And yet its mimic motion made constant cry, caused constantly a cry. That was not ours, although we understood, inhuman, of the veritable ocean. The sea was not a mask, no more was she. The song and water were not medleyed sound, even if what she sang was what she heard. Since what she sang was uttered, word by word, it may be that in all her phrases stirred the grinding water and the gasping wind. But it was she, and not the sea we heard. For she was the maker of the song she sang. The ever-hooded, tragic-gestured sea was merely a place by which she walked to sing. Whose spirit is this, we said, because we knew it was the spirit that we sought and knew that we should ask this often as she sang. If it was only the dark voice of the sea that rose, or even colored by many waves, if it was only the outer voice of sky and cloud or the sunken coral water-walled, however clear, it would have been deep air, the heaving speech of air, a summer sound repeated in the summer without end and sound alone. But it was more than that, more even than her voice, and ours, among the meaningless plungings of water in the wind, theatrical distances, bronze shadows heaped on high horizons, mountainous atmospheres of sky and sea. It was her voice that made the sky acutest at its vanishing. She measured to the hour its solitude. She was the single artificer of the world in which she sang. And when she sang, the sea, whatever self it had, became the self that was her song, for she was the maker. Then we, as we beheld her striding there alone, knew that there never was a world for her except the one she sang and singing made. Ramon Fernandez, tell me, if you know, why, when the singing ended and we turned toward the town, tell why the glassy lights, the lights in the fishing boats at anchor there, as the night descended, tilting in the air, mastered the night and portioned out the sea, fixing emblazoned zones and fiery poles, arranging, deepening, enchanting night. Oh, blessed rage for order, pale Ramon. The maker's rage to order words of the sea, words of the fragrant portals, dimly starred, and of ourselves and of our origins, in ghostlier demarcations, keener sounds. That's really, the 20th century has no finer, I think. I mean, one of the reasons that's so beautiful is because it is such a profound affirmation of what art is and what it can do. Mm. To arrange, deepen, and enchant the night is quite an accomplishment, is it not?
Yeah, indeed.
And to offer us words of ourselves and our origins.
Mm.
Mm. What more can we ask for?
I mean, it really is up there, isn't it, with the great work.
I think so. And I do, actually, I will say, now since we're talking about this influence question, there is passages of this poem which I do hear myself. Mm. And I think I stole this from Stevens, I didn't realize it. It's one of qualification. Listen to the way her voice, a summer sound repeated in the summer without end and sound alone. But it was more than that. More than her voice, than ours, among the innumerable theatrical devils. It was her voice that made the sky accused as vanished. It was more than that. It's something I love to do, is to say what somebody is saying, but wait a minute, there's something else to say about that. Or I can extend that further, and that's a poetic gesture that I find very appealing. Mm. It's a way to say what is and also ask you to think a little harder or go a little further into something.
Mm. I see that in your work. So before we finish this part of the evening, and then we'll have a cup of tea, and then we'll come back and hear more of Mark reading Stevens. I thought it'd be good. I mean, if you were to say to everybody, you know, go home and read one of Stevens' poems, which one would it be?
Well, that one. And I would also read Sunday Morning, which I'll read in a little bit. Sunday Morning is a poem about simply a woman is sitting in a sunroom in her house. Presumably, she's in Connecticut. And she has a green rug with a cockatoo on it and some flowered curtains. And she's thinking about Christianity. She's considering the way that sacrifice has been held up as the necessity for spiritual transformation. And she's just not buying it. it's the color of the cockatoo. It's the green in her drapes. Those are the things that are renewing to her. It's green. Mm. In this poem, green is very positive.
Yeah,
it is. You notice all the blue and the idea of order, less the great blue, meaningless distances, right? Mm. So there's interesting opposition going on there. Mm. But it's a remarkable poem.
Mm. Mm. And
it's the poem where he tells us that death is the mother of beauty, which I was sincerely hoping I would not be asked to discuss.
Yes, we were talking about a comic interview where I said, okay, so first of all, tell us why death is the mother of beauty.
Is the emperor of ice cream the only emperor?
Yes. You could do a whole interview of questions that are impossible to answer. Anyway, we decided not to do that.
Okay,
that conversation.
Yeah, good thing.
So just to finish, I just thought we might finish by saying something. Why should people read Stevens? What will they get? He's not an easy poet. You know, the collected is quite considerable, and even that's not got everything in it. We've now had a corrected collected, with the odd, which you think, oh, I thought when it would be a corrected collected, you think, oh, it's really obvious, you know, you miss the line that says I'm walking down the street thinking this stuff. But actually it's just the odd full stop, it's a comma, you know. So it's not that corrected. You look at it at first and you... I mean, I found when I first read Stevens, I didn't understand a word. Why persist with him? What will a reader gain from Stevens, do you think?
Well, first you get a quality that belongs to poetry, which I think is essential, which is the sheer enchantment of music, of sounds colliding against each other, of unexpected words in a place that feels right in some inexplicable way. Mm. So you get the joy of language kicking up its heels and behaving marvelously. And even if it means nothing, that can be a great pleasure. So I recommend for that. Mm. And then the acuity of evocation of all kinds of things, those... Mm. Okay, those clouds. Let's see. The meaningless plungings of water in the wind, theatrical distances, bronze shadows heaped on high horizons, mountainous atmospheres of sky and sea. Does that just nail something about walking along the beach and the kind of sky landscape you see? Mm. Oh, the sunken coral, water-walled. That does the first thing I was talking about. It's incredibly pleasing and surprising use of language. So we get... the pleasure for the ear, a pleasure for the eye in having something we have seen named in an accurate way, and then something else is churning under there. And what is it exactly? It's not emotion in the usual sense of emotion. This poem is not full of something like grief or love for another person or hope. It's full of an exhilaration of thinking about what it is to be alive. Mm. And that's not the easiest thing to find, that exhilaration in understanding experience and naming it, even if it's terrible. But it is better to have things named than not said. Mm? Mm. So finding someone saying his despair, his search for meaning, his joy in what he can't take joy in, is, to my mind, one of the things that
makes life worth doing, you know, if we can't say where we are. So I think that's a great gift to be drawn from these poems.
That's a great way to finish. Thank you very much, Margaret.
Thank you.